Well, let me thank you again for your attendance tonight. We are going to continue the series of studies that we began on Thursday evening with the primary consideration of the superiority of Christ. And we're looking at that from several perspectives. Those perspectives are those that the Apostle Paul chose in Colossians chapter 2. And so I think it's important that we recognize the things that we began discussing on Thursday night and different perspectives that we look at are things that have held the concern of God's people from ancient times. The Apostle Paul dealt with that in the text that we looked at. If you, just for your kind of the visual consideration, in Colossians chapter 2, as Paul talks to the Christians at Colossae, he is the point of that chapter, the theme of that chapter is the superiority of Christ. What he does is he generally takes about six topics or so and he puts them in phraseology or terminology that they would understand. We're going to put it in what we understand in just a moment. So we've talked about some of those. Our study is organized like this. We talked about human reasoning on Thursday night and the superiority of Christ over human reasoning. Last night we dealt with a related topic to that and the superiority of Christ over human philosophy. And so tonight we're going to deal with the phrase that Paul used was Christ's power over or superiority over the principalities and power, the authorities of this world. And they'll fall into several contexts that we'll look at in just a moment. Tomorrow we will cover the three topics of the superiority of Christ over mysticism in our Bible class, of human religion in the AM period, and then tomorrow night we will conclude with the superiority of Jesus Christ over the Noahic and the Mosaic covenants. And so we'll look at that. So thank you again for being here tonight. If you would like, I chose my title from a passage from Romans chapter 13 where the Apostle Paul is talking about the civil government. And he makes the point that there is no authority but from God. And so we're going to kind of begin our study in thinking about the different kinds or different contexts of authority beyond the authority of Christ for a moment, although they are connected and they are interrelated, as you'll see in just a moment when we consider these things. The first thing that we need to recognize as we look at the different realms of human authority, and I'm going to break them generally into three realms of authority that someone other than Christ would have over us. But I want to point out, I think it is imperative for this study to understand it properly, that all three of these realms of authority are ordained and authorized by God. That's important for us to recognize. I think the primary reason that it's important for us to recognize is when we begin to walk outside of these authorities, we are also walking outside of the ordination and the authority of God, and so therefore we need to consider separating ourselves from these realms very carefully. It's not that we never would, but we need to consider it cautiously because these are realms that God has authorized. And so let's begin with probably in most of our minds the most obvious consideration of the topic of authority, and it's really on our mind right now. What I think we're down to 50 some odd days before the presidential election, and I say every year I'll be glad when that's over with, just so I don't have to hear the advertisements on TV anymore. But we think about the civil government and the fact that it has authority over us. Well, we recognize God ordained that. That wasn't my idea. It wasn't Thomas Jefferson's idea. It was God's idea. God. Now I will share this with you. We'll share this with you. I think God intentionally intended it to be a very poor substitute for something else, and the something else is illustrated in 1 Samuel chapter 8 when the people of Israel rebel against God as their king and say, "We want a king like everybody else." I would argue that even for Israel, God never intended specifically for a human king. He had intended that those people answer to Him as their king, civil and otherwise. And they rebelled against Him. And so I believe that, yes, God ordained it, but He intentionally intended it to be kind of a poor substitute for what we should have chosen as mankind. But in Romans chapter 13 and verse 1, the Apostle Paul weighs in on this topic and the ordination of it. And so let's look just for a moment, kind of understand this, because it is critical that Christians understand our relationship to the civil government. That's not the primary focus of our study tonight, but we do need to understand it. Paul says in Romans chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God." Now, for the sake of our study, and again, this is the relationship of Christian to civil government is a deep and a broad topic. But for the sake of our study, what is important for our study is there in verse 1, where he is confirming for us God-ordained authority. I want you to remember who's in civil authority at this time, because that would have been, verse 1 would have been a bitter pill to swallow for a Roman Christian. Nero is the Caesar when he penned that. I'll be honest with you, I would have said, "Oh, come on, Paul. Let's consider this. Really? Do we have to? Let's sit down and talk about this. Can't we reach a compromise? Do I really have to? Are you really telling me that Nero has obtained his authority from God?" I'm going to tell you something. I think the answer is yes. We might not understand the reason why, but I think the answer is yes. It doesn't justify his ungodliness, but the authority of civil government, good and bad, is authority given by God. Now, it doesn't justify somebody mismanaging it, because God, the inspired writers continue to weigh in on what they should do with that authority and that power. And the answer is, you know, it is there for a reason. They are ministers of God to execute what is right and do what is right and to punish what is wrong. And so God gives them some guidance in that, and if they violate that, God will judge them. But there is that realm of authority. It is given by God. There is another realm of authority that we always consider, and that is within the local church. And that's the only context I'm using the word church here in this study. That's it. So there is a realm of human authority within the local church, and that is the eldership. They are humans. And again, it is a spiritual relationship, but still they are humans that have some degree of authority over me. If I am going to associate myself with that congregation, if I'm going to submit myself to their leadership, then they have a degree of authority. They do. We need to get beyond the idea that elders don't have any authority. They do. And we're going to come back to this topic later on, specifically on this one and another point, and talk in some detail. But 1 Peter chapter 5 verse 17 deals with the idea that that is ordained by God. The next one that we're going to consider is the idea of the home. That's another place that there is authority that is ordained by God. Authority that is given by God, that God says it exists. Husband is to be the head of the house. We're going to come back and we'll talk a great specificity on that point as well. But there are the three realms that in general, listen during the sermon if you want to challenge and find a fourth and fifth realm of a human authority that I've not found. Find it later. Let me know. I'll add it to this lesson. I'm sure there's more out there, but limited by time, we're going to deal predominantly with these three, because every one of us realize in reality these are kind of the big three. These are the ones that probably do in the 90 percentile have. I suppose I could have put students and teachers up there and a few other things. Employee, employer. I get it. But these are the three we're going to concentrate on, because really, these really are the three that are so spiritual in nature, and we're really going to concentrate on those last two. Honestly, we can pray for our civil government, we can vote, we can be involved, we can speak, and so on, but that's kind of the limit of it. These other two have much greater ramifications, and so we're going to predominantly concentrate on there. To do that, I want us to look at some case studies of competing loyalties. Because let me say, this is where the idea and the challenge between the greatness of divine authority over the sometimes frailty of human authority come into, when they begin to clash, is when we have competing loyalties. So the question is, what do I do if the civil government as a Christian is asking me to do something that I cannot and remain loyal to God? What if I am a wife or a child of a husband or a father who is asking me to do something that I cannot? Or what if I, as a Christian, am being asked by an elder to do something or not do something that conscientiously I cannot? This is where it becomes difficult. There are other perspectives in all of these things, but competing loyalties is when we really begin to see the superiority of the authority of Christ. And it is a question of priority. Who gets my priority and how do I apply that? How do I carry it out? So the first one we're going to look at, we're going to get the government out of the way. First one we're going to look at is in Daniel chapter 5 with an old Daniel now. He's not a 19-year-old kid anymore. He's somewhere pushing 80 or better. We don't know exactly. But he's been in captivity all this time. And he's an older man now. And so if you would, Daniel chapter 5, we're going to look there at the events of one evening in the city. There is a new sheriff in town. There is a new king of the Babylonians by the name of Belshazzar. He is referred to here in some translations as the son of. It is more properly translated the ancestor of, because he was not strictly the actual biological son of Nebuchadnezzar. He was a distant relative of some years. But there, Daniel gets called in. I love the book of Daniel. Daniel gets called in when the dreams and the interpretations and the things start happening that nobody else can explain. Somebody will yell, "Go get Daniel and bring him in here. He'll figure it out for us." And so Daniel is called in for that very event. And I want us to begin with verse 18, as he begins to appeal to this younger and this new king. And he says, "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father or your ancestor, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor." And there is that idea again that God ordained the government of your ancestor. God gave that to him. "And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beast and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with the grass like the oxen and his body was wet with the dew of heavens." And now listen. "Till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdoms of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses." In other words, he had to be humbled. He had to recognize, you didn't earn this. God appointed this to you. And again, we may not understand why. Because honestly, Nebuchadnezzar was not a nice guy. If you want to know more about Nebuchadnezzar, dig into it a little bit. He wasn't a nice guy. And so we may not understand exactly what God's reasons were, but now we have a competing loyalty. We have a competing loyalty between civil government and between loyalty to God. Daniel is in between a rock and a hard place. And let me say, so is Belshazzar. That's really who is under consideration here. That Belshazzar has a choice to make. Daniel tells him the story of this ancestor. Nebuchadnezzar had to be humbled. He had to go out there and live like an animal until he decided, all right, I get the message. God put me where I am. I got it. Now, notice verse 22. "But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." In other words, Belshazzar falls into the camp. You know, they say there's two ways to learn, testimony and experience. I'm an experienced guy. My mother would say, "Son, don't touch that." And I'd wait till she was out of the room and touch it to find out why. She tells a great story about a metal nail file and an electrical outlet. Valuable lesson about electricity. I still can't explain electricity, but I know it hurts. Daniel's point to Belshazzar was, you can't learn by testimony. You knew that. You knew that about Nebuchadnezzar. You had that knowledge and you've chosen not to use it. That very night, The image gets explained, if you'll continue on in verse 24, then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, God. This writing was written. And you're right, if you're thinking it, this is where we get the phrase, the handwriting on the wall. And he says, and this is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command and clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck, made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third rule in the kingdom. I have always believed that that was probably Belshazzar's politically correct response to try to get him to withdraw that prophecy, but it didn't work. Instead of shooting the messenger, I think he was trying to please the messenger to make the message go away. But in effect, God is informing him, Belshazzar, you've been weighed, you've been measured, you've come up short, and you're losing your kingdom. You didn't learn what you should have learned. Not only Belshazzar, but also Daniel are in a position where there is competing loyalties between what is right to do before God and what is right to do before the civil government. And when those two loyalties began to collide and compete, Daniel stood for God. He said, this is what happened. The text goes on in verse 30 and 31 and says, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Great story if you've never read it about, from secular history, about how the engineers of the Persian army took Babylon that night. Great story if you ever get an opportunity. Or we have time, I'll tell you all about it because I think it's a cool story. So, this one case study, let's think about government because I want to spend the balance of our time on other topics. Here we have a case where somebody is faced with, do I make the government happy or do I make God happy? Now look, government is ordained. Daniel, in his speech to Belshazzar, said, God appoints over government whom he would. He appoints those positions. So in effect, Belshazzar, you're there because of that. But, Belshazzar, you've not learned that lesson. In other words, you don't believe it. Nebuchadnezzar did. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had to be nudged a little bit. But Nebuchadnezzar believed it. But you don't. Even though you have that lesson from history, you don't believe it. So you're going to lose your kingdom. God, remember, God appoints. God can take away. He put whoever he wants in that position. It's interesting to continue to see, if you continue on in chapter 6, to see what he does with Darius. Read that at your next opportunity. See what happens with Darius. Darius got the message. He didn't want to be the next guy in line to be slain. He got the message. He honored God. And so, we see that competing loyalty. What do I do? What do I do when there is a competing loyalty as a child of God between my loyalty to God and an authority that God ordained and authorized? What do I do? The answer is you do what Daniel did. You choose God. God's authority is superior to civil government. God's authority is superior to principalities and powers. I'm a longtime student of history. And there's one thing that I think is true of every nation, every empire, every power, every principality. And my friends, I hope I don't see it in my lifetime, don't think I will, but it will happen to our nation because it is just the course of history, is that nations come and go. We don't think of Italy today as a global powerhouse. They were when Paul wrote Colossians. Matter of fact, they weren't a global powerhouse. They were the global powerhouse. We don't much think about Italy like that today. It's a great place to go for really good food and laid-back vacation. Right? That seems to be our purpose for Italy. So understand, those things come and go, and that's the point. Christ remains. His authority is forever, and His authority is greater. Let's look at another case. Let's look at a case of the home, of competing loyalties in the home. Turn over to the book of Esther, if you would. I'm sure there are others, but I think this is a pretty good example of a woman, a wife, who considers the possibility that there is a competing loyalty, but what is right to do before my husband and what is right to do before within my home, and what is right to do before God. Most of you will probably remember the story of Esther. Esther was a Jewish woman who was born and raised in captivity, actually, by her cousin Mordecai. Their lineage would have been taken off into captivity. Ahasuerus, the king that is under consideration here, a Persian king. And so actually Esther, historically, chronologically, is one of the very last pieces of information chronologically that we get from the Old Testament. And so Ahasuerus starts with another wife, Vashti. But Vashti had a mind of her own. And when he wanted to kind of show her off to all of his buddies and all of the governors, and he said, "Come on up here, honey, I want to show you off." She said, "I'm not coming." And you know, she had a mind of her own, didn't show up, so he put her away and said, "I want a new wife." And Esther was the choice. But he didn't know she was Jewish. Her cousin Mordecai, a Jew, finds out that one of the chief men in Ahasuerus' court, a man by the name of Haman, is plotting to kill the Jews in Persia. These are the ones that remained behind. Everybody else, the 50,000 in the first, the 5,000 in the second return had already gone back to Israel. These are the ones that remain. Mordecai found that out. Mordecai comes to Esther. He comes to Esther and he says in chapter 4, he sends a messenger to her and says, "You have to intervene on the part of your people. You have to intervene on the part of the people of God." If you'll notice chapter 4 and verse 10, this is the message that goes back, or verse 11, this is the message that goes back to Mordecai. "All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces knows that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go in to the king these 30 days." In other words, she says, look, just because I'm married to him doesn't mean that I can just walk in there and talk to him. But Mordecai says it's critical. It's important. And he sends this message back to her in verse 14. He says, "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" She had a competing loyalty. The people of God, and therefore by extension doing what was right before God and seeing to His authority, and her husband, and in this case, her own safety. What do I do? Mordecai's advice to her is, this is providential, or at least maybe. He doesn't specifically. He said, "Who knows?" I really do love the way Mordecai phrased it. Who knows that this is not the purpose? You know, I would challenge you sometimes to ask yourself that. Who knows? You know, there have been several times at congregations, two or three times now in the last 10, 12 years, congregations have called me and asked me, "Would you come work for me?" It didn't work out. And I was sorely disappointed. Until I found out what happened next, you know. And the congregation falls apart, or they have a big split, or they have all kinds of trouble or something. And me and my wife go, whew. Who knows? Who knows that I wasn't supposed to stay where I was? That's what he considered. But she has a competing loyalty. Do I do what's right before God, or do I do what's right before my husband? But what's right before my husband is not rock the boat. Keep the peace, don't say anything. She rocks the boat. And God blesses her. And it works out. Haman is hung. The Jews are saved. And Mordecai takes Haman's job. Esther remains the queen. It's a great story of faith. And so there we have the idea of competing loyalties in the home. What about spiritual government? The best one that I can think of, if you'll turn over to first, I misquote this. I'm sorry. I got my chart wrong. Go to 1 Samuel 18. Ignore 1 Kings 26. I'm sorry. I was thinking two things at the same time when I typed that. 1 Samuel chapter 18. Most of you are familiar with this story as well. This is the story of the resentment of Saul over David. David is a young boy, has just returned from killing Goliath, this giant. Oh, by the way, a mission that he was given by Saul. Go ahead and do this if you're willing. And so in verse 7 of chapter 18, when he returns back, the women sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. How do you think Saul swallowed that one? Here I am, the king, and this little shepherd boy kills one guy and comes back and all of a sudden is a hero. He didn't like it. From that point on, he sought to get David. He was out to get him. And so, notice verse 9. So Saul eyed David from that day forward. And verse 11. Saul cast the spear, for he said, I will pin David to the wall. More than once, Saul attempts to kill David. And then the tables turn. Notice 1 Samuel chapter 24. 1 Samuel chapter 24, beginning in verse 4. Then the men of David said to him, This is the day of which the Lord said to you, Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you. And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. Now we're going to come right back there to verse 6 in just a moment. But understand, he gets an opportunity. Saul lets his guard down on the battlefield and steps into a cave. David and his men are there. David, you can almost see those men saying, what luck. Here he is. This is your chance. Take him out. This speaks volumes about the character of David. Because I'd have been the guy elbowing him saying, this is your chance. David sneaks up behind him, takes his sword out, cuts off the corner of his robe. I think it's obvious I was here. I could have and didn't. This really speaks volumes about the character of David because he says, that was haughty. I shouldn't have done that. You know, I'd have been the guy when Saul left the cave, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? David doesn't like it. If he didn't like that he did that. Notice what he says in verse 6. The Lord forbid that I have to do this thing to my master. The Lord's anointed to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. David gets it. David sees something that everybody else misses. Saul's not acting properly individually. Saul's not living by a code of godly character, but he is still the anointed of God. God put him in that position. I will not be the one to lift my hand against him. I don't understand the reason, but for some reason, he is the anointed of God. I don't have to agree with what he did. I don't have to tell him what he did was the right thing to do, but I will not lift my hand against him. The amazing thing is he gets the same opportunity in chapter 26 and doesn't do it again. This time, he simply leaves a spear next to Saul's sleeping head. Again, I was here, I could have, I did not. I have always wondered if that was not David's way of saying to Saul, don't continue to pursue me. I've let you off over and over, let's end this. It's wrong. Tragically, Saul commits suicide at the end of his life. Shamed. And so here you have competing loyalties within the realm of spiritual government where David says, I can't raise my hand against the anointed of God. So in the balance of our time, we've given case studies, examples. In the balance of our time, I want us to talk about number one, connect these things back to the example of the greatest leadership and authority that there is, and that is Christ. I want you to know we are going to concentrate on these last two, the home and spiritual government. We're going to leave civil government behind for the remainder of our lesson. We're going to concentrate on the home and the spiritual government because of the home and church, there is an image there is a figure that Christ uses to try to convey the idea of what real spiritual authority and leadership looks like. And so let's think about that. I would ask you to turn your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 5 and verses 1 through 4. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. The elders who are among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. That's his introduction in that part. Now listen to his instructions. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, but not by compulsion, but willingly. Not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Notice the figure that he uses to describe the kind of leadership and therefore the kind of authority that he's dealing with. He uses the figure. He says in verse 2, shepherd the flock. This word from the Greek poimen, or at least from the root poimen, is where we get the word pastor. Be a shepherd. It could be used as a noun. It could be used as a verb. Shepherd the flock of God. Be a pastor to them, which is among you, serving as overseers. And then he gives some qualifications or some caveats to that. Not but. Not by compulsion, but willing. Not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Verse 3, I think, is critical. And in the figure that he uses to describe this, also should be resounding to us when he said, and it connects back to this idea of shepherd. It connects back to that. We'll bring it full circle in just a moment. But in verse 3, he says, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. This is what he is saying about authority within the spiritual realm, but it is a human authority because he's dealing with human beings, dealing with elders in a local congregation. But this is what he says. This is how I want you to lead. I want you to be a shepherd. You know what being a shepherd means? He didn't say, I want you to be a rancher, a cowboy, a cattleman. You know what the difference between sheep and cattle are? I raise both. The difference between sheep and cattle, and if you don't believe me, come to East Tennessee and I'll prove it one day. You push cows, you lead sheep. If you try to herd sheep anywhere, it's like herding cats. Because their inclination is to turn around and follow you. And if you're trying to push them and they're behind you, it doesn't happen. Peter is trying to convey that here. You shepherd the flock, pastor the flock. What does this figure mean of the people that you're following? They're sheep. Let me tell you again, being a sheep raiser, that's not a compliment. There's a lot of baggage that goes with that as well. But he's telling them, shepherd the flock, lead them. Verse 3 is connected to that leadership. Not being lords over them. I've always thought it was interesting that the place, and we're going to connect this in just a moment. The place that leaders, the laboratory for leadership that elders are to have is not in the corporate room, not on the battlefield, not in the classroom. It is in the home. And it says if he can't rule over his house, if he can't lead the people of his own house, he's not going to lead the household of God. That's where the test is. I think that is the case because that's a lot harder than the boardroom or the battlefield. It's tough leading people that you're that emotionally connected to. It's tough leading people who have seen you at your worst. And if tend to remember your worst best better than your best. That's difficult. He says, don't lord over them. I heard somebody make a point one time that of a man who was under consideration of elder and said he has years of leadership experience in the business world. I do not care. Different kind of leadership. I've got years of experience in leadership in the military. I do not care about that. It doesn't make any difference. Might give you some tips and techniques, some procedures, but look, beyond that, that's not the test of leadership. This is the kind of leadership that says you don't do it just by the fact that you hold authority. That's the difference between human and divine authority. Jesus was the kind of person who was a servant leader. He wanted you to follow Him. He was not going to push you. Have you ever noticed that in all of the dealings that Jesus had with His disciples, He never forced anyone into compliance? And so when we begin to compare this with Jesus' leadership and think about the superiority of the authority of Jesus over human authority, we need to recognize that's the example that He gives us in the realm of human authority within a local congregation. Lead from the front. Lead by example. Never lord it over them. Bring them along. Patiently lead them where they need to go. We'll come back to that figure in just a moment, because in our other context that we're thinking about it, the same thing is said. Similar thing. Ephesians chapter 5, we're going to consider the home. Notice now, let's go back and let me connect this for you. The example that is given to elders of leadership is Jesus. That's the example. The example of leadership that is given in the home is Jesus. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for her, that He might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the Word, that He might present her to Himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. If we were to back up to verse 22, it starts out Paul talking to the wives. Christ is the head of the church. Husband is head of the wife. This is normally when all the husbands elbow their wives. Honey, pay attention. Listen very carefully. I have long said this. I believe it with all of my heart. The submission of a wife to her husband is not the wife's issue. It's the husband. If your wife is not in submission to you, it's your problem, probably not hers. Why? Because you're not a leader like Jesus. Your human authority is too frail. And until you bring your authority in line with His authority, she can never be the woman that she's supposed to be before God. When He says, husbands, love your wives, think about it from this perspective. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church, and gave Himself for her. You know why we men normally translate that? We take it back to the death of Jesus and say, honey, if the time came, I'd die for you. I'd take the bullet for you, darling. You know why we say that? Because we're pretty sure it's never going to happen. We're pretty confident it's never going to happen, that something's going to happen, whether it's going to be me or her. I'm going to tell you something. That's not what that passage says. That's not what that passage means. When that passage, when Paul is saying he so loved the church and gave Himself for her, he is telling us he gave the living part of His life for her. He lived for her. He gave up everything He could have been for her. He served His wife. Until husbands get out of this concept that she works for me, you're both spiritually in trouble. She doesn't work for you. If you're the leader that you're supposed to be, like Jesus was, hate to break it to you, but you work for her. You're a servant to her. And if you're a servant to her, you know what? Almost, you know, we're painting with a broad brush, but almost inevitably, you know what happens? She no longer has trouble complying with verse 22. Let your husband be the head. She's not going to have trouble with that. Why? She's got the best thing going. She has a servant for a leader. She has a servant like Jesus was a leader and a servant to His people. And so when we consider the authority of the world, human authority, whether it be in civil government, whether it be in the church, whether it be in the home, it is a frail comparison to the authority of Jesus. But here's what our Lord was kind enough to do for us, is to tell us, at least in two of these realms, if you leaders, elders, and husbands will be servant leaders, like Jesus was a servant leader to His people, you know what? You're not going to have the problems of great rebellion. You're going to make it, people respond to that. God's people respond to that. God's people respond to elders who are engaged. There's a book out, just came out about 6-7 years ago, written by a doctor by the name of Lynn Anderson. Matter of fact, he preaches at a sizable institutional congregation down here in Nashville. He wrote a book. The best part of the book is the title. It's about spiritual leadership. The title of the book is "They Smell Like Sheep." You know what that means? You can, again, my family raises sheep. For years we showed for 4-H and FFA. One year we were down in Cookeville at the state finals. It was all over with. We pack up. We all jump in my truck. Sheep are in the back in the trailer. And inevitably when we did this, it was July. It was hot. We jump in the truck, and before I could get the air conditioner cranked up, somebody would say, "Whew, man, we stink." You know what we smelled like? We smelled like sheep. You know why? We were engaged. We were engaged. We were washing them. We were holding them. We were picking them up. We were moving them. We were feeding them. We were watering them. We were seeing to their every need. Why? I'm their shepherd. Spiritual leaders, whether here in the congregation or here in the home, have to be engaged. They have to smell like sheep. They have to know what's going to happen before it happens. They have to know. They have to watch. They have to prowl the flock. Whether it is in the home, whether it is in the church, they've got to be there. They've got to know. They've got to understand. Jesus did. Turn to John 10 quickly before we run out of time, because I got one more point I want to make. Let me demonstrate this again. Let's show this from the perspective of Jesus. John 10, Jesus is trying to convey to the Pharisees this very idea of spiritual leadership from the standpoint of His authority. And this is a great place for us to bring this full circle. Because here we're talking about human leadership, and He's basically saying, if you want good human leadership, you follow the greatness of divine authority and divine leadership. And He says, beginning in verse 10, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep know hear his voice." Skip down to verse 7. "Most assuredly I say to you, I am the door of the sheep." Now I recognize that most people look at that and think they understand exactly what that means. Let me explain it to you in shepherd's terms. This is what it really means. In ancient Palestine, there were sheepfolds all over the place, which were little rock corrals, sometimes on the mouth of a cave. They would build a little rock corral. There was one way in and one way out. That was it. The sheep would go in at night. If there were goats with that flock, guess which side of the sheepfold the goats were in? Anybody want to guess? Left. Sheep to the left, goats to the left, sheep to the right. There's a reason He said that. That was tradition. And then, when they were all in there, and they were all safe, and they were all bedded down, and they were all taken care of, the last thing to consider was the protection from predators. And you know what that shepherd would do? That shepherd would take his club. He would take it out. He would set his staff next to him on that rock wall. He would take his robes and pull around him, and he would sit down in that one opening and lean back up against the rocks, and that's where he was going to sleep tonight. He became the door of the sheep. In other words, they're not getting out without going over me, and the dogs aren't getting in without going over me. These are my sheep. You want them? We're going to fight. Later on down in this text, he says this as well. He says, verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. Now notice the distinction here. But a hireling who is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he is a hireling and does not care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd. A hireling was a day wage earner. In other words, I'll be here at sunrise, I'll work till the sun set, you'll give me my day's wages, and I'll disappear. And I don't care what happens on my shift. If you lose everything, I'm still getting paid at the end of the day. Let me ask you a question. For $7 an hour, would you fight a grizzly bear? Not me. Or a wolf? Or a pack of wild dogs? No, that's Jesus' point. The hireling, the guy who doesn't take this seriously, the guy who's really not a shepherd, the guy who's really not a servant, when the danger shows up, he's gone. Jesus says, I'll be there. That's the great distinction between human and divine authority. I'll be there. Jesus says, I'll be there for you. I'm not going to run from the wolves. I'll be there for you. They've got to get through me to get to you. In John chapter 13, as we bring this around, in John chapter 13 now, there is a touching scene in the last few hours that Jesus spends with His apostles that demonstrates the profound power of divine authority over nature itself demonstrated in such great humility. Remember, this man is just a man. He can suspend. He was the Creator. He was there at the creation. He is the Son of God. He could calm the seas. He controls nature. And with all of that greatness, this happens at the Passover Supper. Verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into His hand, and that He had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside His garments, took a towel and girded Himself. After that, He poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which He was girded. Then He came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to Him, Lord, are You washing My feet? Jesus answered and said to him, What I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this. Peter said to Him, You shall never wash My feet. Jesus answered him, If I do not wash you, you have no part with Me. Simon Peter said, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not all of you. For He knew who would betray Him, therefore He said, You are not all clean. So when He had washed their feet, taken His garments and sat down again, He said to them, Do you know what I have done to you? You call Me teacher and Lord, and you say, Well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Jesus sets an example. He says, look, this is why. If you want to be a part of Me, you take this example and you live it. You live it. You live your discipleship. You live that humility. You consider others. You be the servant leader. Notice again in the church and in the home, in effect, and Christians wrestle with this. This is what we're going to talk about tomorrow in our two worship periods. Christians wrestle with this, but let me say emphatically, what God is calling us to do is imitate His character. We get this idea that, and certainly it is true that Jesus is divine and Jesus lived perfectly as a man on this earth. And so we buy into the idea that, well, I can't even get close to that. There's no way I can do that. I'm only human after all. But what we will demonstrate tomorrow, what I believe that we demonstrate in all of this, John 10, the example of John 13, 1 Peter 5, Ephesians 5, is that Jesus is saying to us, imitate me. Be like me. Share my character. You can come to that level. Does it mean we're going to be perfect? Probably not. We're going to slip and fall from time to time. Should that be the goal? Yes, it should. Jesus is saying, imitate my character. This is the answer. It's not just a carrot and stick. Obey me and I'll be obligated to save your soul. Imitate me. Live like me. Live my example. Live my character. And you'll quit committing sins. And you can enter into the glory of your Father in heaven. It can be done. The authority of Jesus Christ is greater than the authority of human beings. But we need to, I want you to leave this place, particularly in these two contexts, understanding that I can imitate Jesus in my leadership. If you are an elder, or if you aspire as a younger man to be an elder, and I pray that you will, this is the kind of leadership that God is looking for. They smell like sheep because they are intimately involved. They are there. They are present. They know. They feel. They are involved. Husbands of any age, of all ages, if you've made mistakes for decades, quit making mistakes and do better. Be a servant to your wife like Jesus was to the church. Forget this idea of, honey, I'd die for you. That's the least we can do. Is shed our blood for it, but that's not what he's saying. Until we get to that point that we understand, honey, because, you know, I see a lot of guys, honey, I'd take the bullet for you, but I'm not going to miss the ball game for you. I'd take the bullet for you, but there ain't no way I'm going shopping with you. Jesus lived for His bride. We need to live for our brides. Divine authority is better than human authority. Human authority will let you down every time. Every single time, human authority is going to disappoint you. If you don't believe me, read history and politics and government. Human authority will disappoint you. But even humans in authority who follow the divine example of divine authority can produce great things. We have that capacity. That's what Jesus is trying to bring us into the understanding of. Imitate me. Live like me. I'm your example. Have my character. And all of these things begin to fall into place. But the greatest example of humility, authority, and leadership, servant leadership that Jesus ever displayed, is when He did. Let's get beyond the cruelty of the cross and the fact that He died, but more importantly, the fact that He carried my sin. A lot of people have died for other people, let's face it, for a lot less reasons. But that's not the significance of His death. The significance of His death, and I would submit this to you, in that moment in the garden when Jesus cries to the point that blood begins to flow, and He says to God in prayer, if it is possible, let this cup pass. I've heard all my life preachers say He was talking about the cruelty of the crucifixion and blood. No, He wasn't. There are plenty of examples from secular history from people who were burned to death with a smile on their face for the cause of Christ. That's not what it was. This is what it was. Jesus knew for the next 3 days He was going to be separated from His Father because He bore the weight of the world's sin. That's what He asked to pass. That's what caused the anxiety. It wasn't the thought of being nailed to a cross. He had the moral, He had the physical courage to do that. Other people had worked up the physical courage to do that. Jesus' anxiety was I'm going to be separated from the pleasures of my Father. I'm going to be separated from relationship with my Father for 72 hours, for 3 days. My friends, how should it frighten us that we gamble with eternity away from God? If Jesus was brought to the edge of collapse over the thought of being separated from God for 3 days, that was His greatest act of leadership. When He said, I will bear your burden of sin. There is no greater leadership. There is no greater authority. There is no greater act of service. And He did it. And you know what He calls on us to do? He calls on us to be the same character. That act gave us hope. That act gave us an example by where we will live, that if we live in accordance with His Word, in the right way, in the right motivation, if we bend our will to His character, we have a hope of eternity. We have a hope. We don't have to worry about the thoughts of being separated from God for an eternity. We can be in the presence of God for an eternity. That's what He asks us to do. If you're here tonight, you've not named His name as a child of God and become a Christian and began that walk with Him, you are gambling with eternity. It's not worth it. His authority is the greatest. His authority is the best. His authority is the greatest example. We can use it and apply it to our own lives. If you're here tonight, you're subject in any way, don't put it off. Make your heart right. Make yourself prepared for eternity tonight as we stand together and as we sing.